Hello everyone, and welcome to the auditorium for tonight's event with Terry Kelly to celebrate the publication of the Extreme Centre. Before we get started, I'd just like to ask that you make sure your mobiles are switched to airplane mode or off, as we will be recording tonight's event, and to say that we do have copies of our speakers' books available in the foyer so that there will be a signing after the event, so do pick one up and pay at any of the till points throughout the building. So chairing tonight's event, we're very happy to welcome back Professor of Geography and author of Inequality in the Modern Sense, Danny Doyle, who will be in conversation with author, journalist, filmmaker and editor of New Left Review, Terry Kelly. Please give a huge round of applause to Danny Doyle and Terry Kelly.
Thank you all very much for coming. We're going to have a little chat and then we're going to open up to questions. So, our only prepared question is the first one. What's going to happen on May 7th?
What is happening on May 7th? That's the first reply that comes to mind. Will it make any difference? See, who knows what is going to happen on May the 7th. One thing that is being predicted is that none of the two mainstream parties will get an overall majority. And that already marks a shift in British politics. That things that were taken for granted, the reason why the first-past-the-post system under which we operate was set up was to give one party an absolute majority. And most of the prime ministers that have been elected since 1945, right down to the 90s, have been elected on the basis of the system, usually, not always with a minority of the vote. Mrs. Thatcher never got an overall majority, worth remembering. But now that system is completely outmoded, outdated, but we still use it. So it's almost like a lottery. And if the Conservatives are the largest party, who will they go into coalition with if the Lib Dems are virtually wiped out, as the polls are predicting? Will there be pressure from some hardcore Blairite members of the Labour Party to go into a coalition with the Tories? That's another question. After all, it happens in Germany, it happens in other parts of the world, why not Britain? And of course, the most interesting question is, how is Scotland going to? It's interesting that a part of the United Kingdom, ignored for many years, is now central. If, as the opinion polls are right, and there is a huge trend that is sustained over the next few weeks, and the SNP comes in with 40 members of parliament, if not more, that marks a complete change in British politics, and it marks the decline of the Labour Party, because Scotland is where it was formed, Scotland is where its first manifestos were written, the Scottish working class supplied its first leaders, Keir Hardie for one, Ramsay MacDonald for another. This was the heartland of old Labour, and if this is now wiped out completely, what effect is it going to have on what is left of the Labour Party and on British politics as a whole? I note that senior figures in the British civil service, Jeremy Haywood for one, others, The Economist, you know, people generally on the right in this country are discussing openly that if the Scottish results are as predicted, there might have to be a new constitutional convention in Britain to determine how England and its adjuncts are going to be run afterwards. So that, for me, is the most interesting aspect of the forthcoming elections. how Scotland will vote and what changes will result in the years that follow.
I was just trying to think, they've got 5 weeks to go. So you could do scare stories about pensions, you could say this is all about the housing market in Scotland. You can't send lots of Labour MPs up anymore, that won't work, it didn't really work last time. But if you think about the concerted effort that was done at the last minute, you know, you tell the BBC they've really got to behave themselves, isn't that likely?
I think you may even cry wolf once or twice. But I think that the Scots were promised by Cameron and all the other party political leaders from Westminster huge changes. And Nicola Sturgeon, when she became leader of the Scottish National Party, said that of these changes promised, very few have actually been fulfilled. And I go to Scotland a lot, so I meet people from all walks of life and all political opinions and talk to them. And many people within the Labour Party who are still in the Labour Party are incredibly demoralised and will probably jump ship very soon because they say, you know, we've got a better chance with the SNP than we had with Labour. We hate saying this to you. It's awful, but this is the result of our Westminster in relation to Scotland. And people have been telling me that quite a few people who voted against independence will make up for it by making sure they're large numbers of SNP members of the Westminster Parliament. It works out like that.
I want to know how you came to call the book the extreme middle. I mean,
extreme centre.
Extreme centre.
Yeah.
I can remember the first time I heard the phrase intelligent right and left being used in a derogatory way. I mean, if you weren't a Blairite or you weren't mentioned Conservative Party, you were just some fantasist. Or grown-up politics was my favourite phrase.
Yeah.
You know, you're not involved in grown-up politics if you're not in the middle. So how did you come up?
Well, I don't know. It was a throwaway phrase I came up with in the course of a public lecture. Somewhere in Europe, observing the European scene. And people liked it, and it stuck, and I began to think about it more and more, that actually, the huge problem that we confront at the moment in European politics, and North American politics too, is not that of an extreme right, which is on the verge of seizing power, or the extreme left, which is up for a week, but an extreme center, which makes wars, which supports tortures, which defends surveillance on a level unpredicted and unforeseen, which imposes austerity. These are measures which in the 25 years ago we would have seen as rather extreme measures. And therefore, for me, whether you belong to a centre-left party, supposedly Labour, or a centre-right party, Conservatives or the centre party like Lib Dem. How do you define this prime word in this country? Well, effectively they agree on fundamentals, on all the major basic issues of the day, politically and economically, they are in agreement. And the recent ITV or Channel 4 Sky television debate between Cameron and Miliband, one could feel more sympathetic to Miliband, or at least I could as a human being. But in terms of what he was saying politically, there was not much in it. They will carry on with the austerity. They will carry on in many other fields as the Tories have done, as the Tories are carrying on with what the previous Labour government did. So this is the extreme centre, and it offers near no real choice in a democracy.
Okay, let's play the... you've got a lot in the book about the Labour Party, particularly all the sins of former cabinet ministers, and I've only asked you about Tony Blair's bottom as well. But if you take the current lot, they are offering to reduce tuition fees to £6,000. They are offering three-year tendencies as a form of mild rent control. You know, there are some things there on the plate, which hadn't been on for a few years.
Well, look, if we go on the tuition fees first, who introduced the tuition fees in the first place? It wasn't the Tories. John Major, Conservative Prime Minister, said publicly that he refused to introduce tuition fees for students because he remembers as a kid he didn't come from a wealthy family. His parents couldn't afford to send him tutors. And he said he thought it was outrageous that young people should be forced to pay for getting a university education. This is a Conservative Prime Minister, John Major. Enter Blair and Brown. And the Treasury puts on Brown's desk, this is how much money we've raised by charging tuition fees, and Labour put it, okay, 6,000 a year tuition fees. All they're now suggesting is that they go back to what they initially proposed. And this is what they do in a lot of things. So you get the impression they're different, but effectively they're not. And so it's good if they reduce the tuition fees. There's nothing to stop the Tories from doing it either. And if they thought this was a central issue, they might well do it. You know, who knows? But whether Labour will really do it remains to be seen. They could do it. But that, for me, is not sufficient. You know, fundamentally, the Labour Party today, Blair's Labour Party, the Labour Party created by Blair on the Thatcherite model, is very detailed. The bulk of the parliamentary party is like that. So, for me, the choice between Labour, Tory and Lib Dem is not a choice at all. I mean, I personally, in my constituency, Haringey, when I look at the candidates and look at the manifestos, I would vote Green. Because the Green Party candidate in my constituency is an excellent person. So why should I vote for the mainstream party? This is not sport or football where they're sort of addicted to football clubs of a particular side. This is politics, and we can't operate in the same way, tribal loyalties. So my advice always to people is that look at the candidates. It's very possible that if you're in Islington and you have Jeremy Corbyn as a candidate who's Labour, I would vote for him. Yeah, because he's a good guy. He's personally, politically, he's good. But I wouldn't vote for a party per se in today's configuration.
Now you've got obviously a lot of the three main parties. You have a lot of Scotland on the book, quite a substantial amount of Greece and Spain and so on. But you don't have much on the Greens in the book. You're going to get a similar number of votes as the SNP, just incredibly inefficiently spread. You know, they need their own country. They all move to Wales. The Greens would have it. But why not say more about the Greens? Is it because it didn't come out to the left? Is that what?
No, not particularly that. I mean, the SNP placed itself to the left of Labour in Scotland without any left, which is why they get so many votes, you know, pledged to stop the billions that are spent on Trident, which is basically money to the American armament manufacturers who make this ready. So there's absolutely no reason why Britain needs nuclear missiles in this country when that has the NATO shield protecting it in any event. So that is, the SNP came out strongly against that, against tuition fees, against any privatizing of the health services, which has been proceeding apace in a small way, you know, salami tactics since Blair was in office, and the Tories have carried it on. So the SNP, I can see why lots of Labour voters, including in strong Labour towns like Glasgow and Dundee, voted for independence. There is no equivalent of that in England. The Greens are beginning to be like that, in my opinion, and Caroline Lucas is an excellent Member of Parliament. I would always vote for her, were she or someone like her in my constituency, as they are. And so I will do. As a party, they're making their way. They haven't totally defined themselves, but they're in the process of that, and they're winning more recruits and members. So it could be that this party could link up with other smaller ones and create a broad progressive umbrella organization that one could vote for. I don't know.
Let's just discuss something that may be more likely possible in the immediate future, which is an SNP-Labour coalition or the support. I met a friend of mine earlier today who has been in CNP for decades, never imagined that their closest hope to unilateral nuclear disarmament was the SNP, which I think, I mean, if there's any take-home message from that, don't think you can, you know, necessarily predict. He told me that there's no way the submarines can be stationed in Northern Haven for various reasons. So if the SNP insist that the decommissioning, or at least not spending any money keeping the musty things going as part of their agreement, Labour can simply say, we had to do it, we still believe in nuclear weapons, but I'm afraid we can't spend this money that we don't have. Is that entirely possible?
It is possible, but extremely unlikely.
Because the Americans won't allow it?
Yeah, the Americans won't allow it. They defend their arms industry. You know, the Saudi Arabian government buys billions of dollars worth of American weapons each year, which are left to rust in the desert. They haven't got an army or an air force large enough to use these, not even with the war in Yemen now. But they certainly can't use them. And the Saudis, for instance, have always been wary of creating too big an army, fearing that it might challenge the monarchy at some stage, because armies in that part of the world have done in the past. And the Trident, on a smaller scale, is just like that. It's paying vassal's money to the big imperial power. Here you are, we'll take it. It's not, in Scotland the figures are very interesting. I don't know what they are anymore. But over 80% of the Scottish people, regardless of whether they voted for or against independence, are against having Tridents in Scotland.
Why not? I mean, the Americans put nuclear weapons in Britain because they needed them. They didn't have submarines when it began. Now they don't need them. They're taking their own cruise missiles out. They don't actually, you know, they can create Armageddon without having to launch it from here. So why not get the vassal money some other way and just concede this?
Well, because it then affects their own hegemony in the ruler of Europe. That is quite an important thing to them. And the money isn't unimportant either. But you would need a government which fought for that. I mean, perfectly possible to push it through. But will Ed Miliband get support for that inside his own party? The bulk of them, if he were in favour, which he says he's not, by the way, because the bulk of the parliamentary Labour Party didn't vote for him, but for his brother, who was a traditional NATO man. And wouldn't even have considered the idea. So I think the SNP Labour, there'll never be a coalition, but keeping a Labour government going, whether they reach agreement or not, I don't know. But were there a vote in the House of Commons, which there is a trick which is often tried, free vote, I think the bulk of the parliamentary Labour Party would vote as the Tories to keep fighting, full stop.
You mentioned Ed's brother. So, I mean, the prince is over the water, kind of been waiting to return. Do you think that's, you know, there or just speculating? Would the Balkan Labour Party really welcome him back as a leader if they...
Well, it will be difficult, I think, because it depends what happens. If the Labour Party is defeated and the Tories form a new government, I think Ed would resign us. Will even the hardcore Blair people in the Labour Party then want another Miliband when one has been defeated? I mean, people think, you know, in this, they think psychologically and not politically. I mean, politically, he'd be like them, but they might think that's a bit much to inflict another one on the electorate. Yeah, and they might try and find someone else, younger and more flashy. I don't know. You know, that's how the leaders are decided upon. So I doubt that. But if he wins and actually forms a government, which falls in 2 years, then it'll be impossible for another government.
I was told it's Chuck Ebenezer or Yvette. That's a coin. he was a huge amount of the book about Amanda Hegley, saying that usually it's not really declining very much, and it's still all powerful. And so I read that and I thought that this is a state in which living standards have been falling for many people, in the bottom for 30 years. It's not like 1950s, 60s America. It's a state which has lost control of South America, Latin America. It's a state which has allowed a black president to be elected in a kind of votes of people at the bottom. It looks like a state, well, the nearest example is us. Well, you know, we are the previous hegemon that went down. Now, apart from the fact that there isn't that obvious candidate in the way, aren't there mirrors with the slow decline of England from being the centre of world empire before?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a truism that no empire lasts forever. But historically speaking, two things. One, empires rise and fall, but the fall is accompanied by the rise of another empire, or a set of empires. This is the first time in the history of humanity that we've had a globe with one single empire. That's never happened before. I mean, the Romans may have thought they were the only empire in the world, but they, you know, had little contact with China, which was a huge empire in its own right. Today, the United States is militarily ahead of the next six countries, which include Russia and China, put together. Very strong, powerful weaponry, which they use when they feel that their hegemony is being challenged or threatened. That's one thing. The second thing is, despite the decline in living standards, they're still much higher than different parts of the world, including China. So one shouldn't forget that. The third thing also, that economically, in terms of industrial production, China is ahead. We know that. And it's the workshop of the world in producing things which are necessary consumer wear, if you like. But in terms of high quality and technically crucial implements and parts for planes, for weapons, the United States are still in the lead. And one shouldn't forget that, I mean, I'm not saying this because I like it, I'm just saying it because it's a fact that the United States came up with the most remarkable innovation of the late 20th and early 21st centuries, which all of you use every single day, computers. I mean, that, and they were developed, processed, produced initially on the West Coast. And even today, with a lot of actual frames of things are done in China, the computers even produced there, the key companies control the Chinese computer market are Apple and others, which have the control of the key crucial parts for these computers under their own control, i.e. control of the United States. So they use China, and that has, of course, had a huge impact in China itself. But China, you know, we could say, in when Britain was on the decline by the 1920s, many people did say that waiting in the wings is the United States of America. That these are the people who will replace the British Empire. No one at that stage said they would replace all the European empires, because no one would think that. But when Britain was the largest empire, everyone thought the Americans would replace it. It's very difficult, if not impossible, in my opinion, to say China is going to replace the empire. Not going to happen. And of course, Danny, the American Empire suffers huge setbacks now and again, but it still goes on. I mean, after it suffered the setback in Vietnam in the last century, defeated militarily and politically in 1975, many people wrote the Americans will never intervene anywhere again. If only.
You've got an interesting knowledge of military hardware in a book called Generations of Stealth Bombers and so on, but there's also security services in a 17 in the US. And you make one argument that says it's unimaginable that the security services are not being used to, well, further the economic interests we know, but other things that would help people. What kind of things were you hinting at there? You took it so far, but then...
Well, I took it so far, you know, one can only speculate. But I think that given my argument in the extreme centre is that we are also living through a period where we are witnessing or experiencing the twilight of democracy. That all that I'm saying about the mainstream parties is not explicable without seeing the decline of democratic institutions, democratic accountability, the right of citizens to intervene, change policies, because if you disagree with the extreme center parties, how do you change policy? True, you can have other political movements, but that's a long process, 20, 25-year process, which you see elements of in Greece and Spain today. But it's not an easy process. And in the United States, where I particularly discuss the surveillance, I think they're nervous not about any foreign intervention, but nervous that there might be explosions inside the United States itself, popular explosions, if people spontaneously come out against something which hasn't been predicted in DC public intelligence service. And one thing I noticed is when those two Chechen Americans exploded a bomb during the Boston Marathon, they were two kids, everyone knew they were two, there was no one more than that. And yet the intelligence services shut down the whole of Boston for over 24 hours. They said to the population, they're terrorists in town. These were two guys. Just stay at home. And I couldn't help feeling when I was observing this on the screen that it was a test run for something more serious, which might happen in the years to come. It was a good thing to test to see if they could get away with it. And they got away with it. But the minute you start thinking that and feel a bit pessimistic, then you see that they cannot stop and could not stop. The young people who marched after the African-American person was shot dead in Ferguson, and then in Brooklyn, that the spontaneous coming out of people went one step beyond the Occupy movements, that they didn't stay in one place, but through the use of social networks and various other means, they brought New York and Brooklyn to a halt by passive resistance in 10 different parts of the city. Now this required but we still don't know how they did it, and thank God we don't. But they did it. And then you sort of, whenever you have a challenge from the security services, something happens in that country, and they challenge it back. And then you feel relieved, and there are people who will not accept these things lying down. But just to conclude on that question, Danny, the power now of the security services to spy on citizens is huge. That's why Snowden went berserk when he saw his boss lying to a Senate committee and saying we never ever spied on American citizens, which he knew was a total lie.
I do wonder the spying, this is my question, the spying, whether it's helpful if you all think you're being spied on as well, because it's like believing in God. You know, you behave better if you think that God can see your sins. But they certainly can monitor everything. It's just that the supercomputers are not that clever, there aren't that many people. But you now know that, you know, everything can be better. Warren Fagner wrote a book called The Short History of the Future two or three decades ago. And in it, he had various scenarios of what might happen. One of which is that the United States falls apart in 2030. Simply internally, dissent rises, people move into different factions, they physically move to different parts of the states, the poor get poorer and poorer, and we've had 30 years of that. He wrote this before that trend took the day. And it becomes uncontrollable, and Hegemony actually just dissolves from within in 20 years from now, the way things, if it carries on like this. Just
look, in your own excellent book on the 1%, you yourself have described the concentration of wealth now in the advanced capitalists. And I ask, if anything might have caused upheavals after the Wall Street crash of 2008, the financial crash, it would have been that. Despite this immense concentration of wealth and disparities, nothing that much happened. In the United States, people went around and targeted individual billionaires and bankers, which is a cop-out in my opinion. Now, you know, it's fine sort of having rude slogans in front of their houses, but it's not the real thing.
I get quite like the people who took the camel onto Lord of One.
Yeah. So nothing all that much happened. And the first signs of a political resistance came, well, this year, in 2015. That is almost 8 years after the crash in Greece and Spain, because they suffered the most, so new political movements grew up. And they're trying now to crush the Syriza government in Greece, because it just wants some Keynesianism and a bit of social democracy. That's all. There's nothing more radical. It's not anti-capitalist per se. It's anti this particular form of privatized, neoliberal, financialized capitalism. So what the book you referred to forecasts could happen, but this is why the American secret services of the FBI are very powerful. They exist in every town. They monitor what's going on. All these young people who came out on these demonstrations, they will check, are they students? If they're students, well, after 3 years, they get jobs or not, but they won't be the same. Are they non-students? In which case, are they African-Americans? Are they Hispanic? Are they unemployed? That could be a problem. And thirdly, constitutionally, there are some states in the United States, including Texas, let's give one example, which, if they wished to, have the right to secede from the United States. And I think probably that would be the form in something really dramatic that took place. Mm-hmm. What would they do? I mean, probably punishment, march, but that in itself,
that's okay. You say something would have happened in 2008. To my mind, 2008 was incredibly well managed.
Yeah.
The cash boys didn't even stop working for one day. I mean, the negotiations over that weekend worked. People in Britain didn't know or appear to realise the pound had fallen in value by a quarter. All that happened is we suddenly noticed you couldn't run holiday. And then you start saying, oh, isn't it very expensive in France? It was the most incredible devaluation of the currency. It was incredibly well managed.
I agree with you entirely. So well managed that they created a very clever an atmosphere of fear. We've all got to stick together because there's no alternative.
But wasn't it well managed because in that situation it made sense to manage it well? The alternative is that the ships turn around, the food doesn't arrive by a box, you get panic, the young do okay, but the old don't.
That's what people felt. But the thing is this, that the only reason they could get away with it, and without making any changes and reversing course when the course needed to be reversed, is because they used taxpayers' money to bail out all of these banks. You know, a lot of these people involved in financial were committing crimes. Some of them were against the law. I mean, not to pay the taxes against the law for citizens. If any of you don't pay your tax, you can be forced to pay it, and if you can't pay it, you can be locked up. But these laws did not apply to large corporations, didn't apply to many of the deeds that the banks were doing, and it was this tectonic break in the financial structure of global capitalism that forced them to spend trillions of dollars in saving it and then keeping it exactly as it is. And this isn't going to last, by the way. If you read or listen to some of the hedge fund dealers themselves, the more intelligent ones, they say, we know it's going to happen again. It's only a matter of time. They can't stay there for too long. So putting sticking plaster on the wounds when what you need is surgery is not going to work. Okay.
And my last question, so please have a think of the questions. The hedge fund managers say this, and they also don't have a great case to fly to either. Going to an island in the Bahamas isn't necessarily that good if the water system doesn't work. But they'll say to you, yes, it's not sustainable. We can't have this rate of compound growth. You know, it looks really bad, but hopefully it won't happen in my lifetime. And then they say to you, but what's your alternative? When your alternative chapter was short, it didn't have much on the greens on it. You know, without an alternative to the middle,
Well, I think that, you know, I didn't sketch out a complete alternative, but I did point out that some of the countries in South America, for instance, who've broken with the neoliberal system, have reverted to a form of left-wing, progressive social democracy, Keynesian measures, using the state to build and shore up the social infrastructure. Which is what the Greeks want to do, but are not being allowed to do by the European Union elite in the grip of the German banks. These are not, if you like, systemic alternatives. There are alternatives within the system, because people do not have the confidence to come up at the moment with a systemic alternative. If we want to abolish capitalism altogether, and this is how we work it. And one reason why they don't is because they haven't recovered from the downfall of the Soviet system, which many equate with socialism, rightly or wrongly. But my answer to that is that system failed once, and capitalism has failed about 70 times. So there are alternatives to be sought and alternatives to be looked for, and they are there, but in order to do that, you need the people and the politicians and political leaders and radical economists to chart out such a course, which is what the Greeks were hoping to do, if they're allowed to do it. If not, it will be chaos in Greece.
Thank you. Now, questions. I've been told I need to repeat your question for the recording, so I'm not being strange when I repeat your question. Have we got any questions, please?
If we do have a radical change, as far as the elections go, what, and we were to have a constitutional convention, a two-part question. One, how would you like to see that run out? And two, is there anything you would particularly like to see come out of that?
If we were to have a conventional constitutional convention, how would you like to see it run, and what would you like to see come out of it?
Well, I dread the thought that it's going to be run by the civil service. if that's what's going to happen, and which is what they would like to do to keep a total control on it. I think there should be a constitutional convention which has elected delegates from every single city. How they're to be elected can be worked out. You know, maybe a special election for this, a constitutional, to establish a constitution, which is no small thing. In a country which prides itself on not having a constitution at all, saying this is a continental vice, where it's an Atlantic vice as well, because the Americans have a constitution. Much, much better to have one. What I would like to see coming out of it is really, because that is all the constitutional convention can do, is propose a new constitution in which I think we need to have a fair, democratic, proportional electoral system. We need to have an elected second chamber. I mean, we need to remove all the anomalies of the English state and its apparatus, because clearly, if they lose Scotland, that is not working. And the only thing a constitutional convention can be used for is to create a structure, a new structure, and one has to fight and argue for this to be the most democratic structure available. I give you one example. There was a referendum in Venezuela several years ago, about 12, 15 years ago now, for a new constitution. And in it, the new regime of Hugo Chavez said that if a certain number of signatures were gathered midterm, or while the president had been in office even for a year, the people had the right to replace the president with a new one. No other constitution has that. And the opposition, mainly right-wing, which had opposed the constitution, fought against it, finally ended up using it. They got the signatures. They had a referendum on a new president to remove Chavez, and they lost. But at least that was there. So there was a huge debate in the why do you want to remove him? Why we don't want to remove him? Why we want to remove him? And the participation of ordinary people enhances democracy. You know, this is the one thing which I noticed in Scotland during the referendum. And many people, including a few of the more intelligent journalists who went to cover it, noticed it as well. That regardless of which way people are going to vote, yay or nay, the political consciousness of the Scottish electorate was right at the top. Everyone was discussing politics. Everyone. And this has carried on, which is why this huge change has happened. So these are some of the things one would want. And by the way, Scotland, the whole campaign for independence was started off by an unofficial convention of Scottish representation, delegates, that this is the Scotland we want. And I think a similar thing in England and Wales would be very positive.
Questions? I hold my own microphone. Have you at the front? Yes.
Clearly, environmental destruction and inequality is built into the DNA of the current system by capitalism. Will that not hasten systemic change and can you envisage an environmental disaster hastening systemic change?
Environmental destruction and inequality is built into the DNA of the current system. Isn't this going to hasten its demise?
Hasn't so far. I mean, we've had environmental disasters. Fukushima in Japan, for instance. Absolutely horrific. And what happened has been covered up to a large extent. And the only people who reacted to it very quickly were the Germans. When Merkel closed down all the nuclear reactors in Germany, or said we're not going to renew these, end of nuclear reactors in Germany. No other European country has done that at all. And in Japan itself, it's now been in the news again, I notice, because a lot of fish turning up on the west coast of the United States were radiated, suffering all sorts of diseases, are being eaten by people on the west coast of the United States, and they're getting diseases, and they're getting some cancer and things. Just a big brouhaha about it a few weeks ago. So that's when they notice, it's when they're struck itself. But leaving that aside, even within Japan, there was shock and horror, because it's not such a large island, you know, that this had happened. But no big systemic change. They're still agitated to have nuclear a country that suffered. So the elites that rule the world, whatever their characteristics and how different they are from each other, by and large are not affected by this. The only thing that changes them is if there's a huge uprising from below, or something on that level. That then forces them to do something, but sometimes they even resist that. And you know, if you look at what has been happening in the Middle East with the use of depleted uranium, with the use of gas in the first Gulf War, I mean, now, years after the first Gulf War ended, the explaining how many American soldiers suffered because they were hit by their own gas. We don't have figures in Britain, but British soldiers suffered it too. So a lot of things are covered up. On its own, the elite would not change. They would, you know, see the planet go up rather than do anything.
Okay, we've got one right at the very back.
What are your thoughts on the situation in Yemen, and what would it take to end the rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran?
What are your thoughts on Yemen and what would it take to end the rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran?
Well, this rivalry has existed for a long time because the Saudi regime is based itself on an old compact with the founder of a variant of Sunni Islam called Wahhabism, which is the most extreme current within Sunni Islam. And I don't like it when people talk about Sunni-Shia rivalry. I've grown up in a world where there were Sunnis and Shias used to intermarry and stuff. This is relatively new, and it's based on state power and state interest. The Iranians, since the Islamic Revolution, have been quite, you know, forward-going in terms of exerting their authority and their influence as a state. And the key element in creating this divide between Saudi Arabia and Iran was the American war in Iraq, backed, of course, by Blair and Labour in this country. Which wrecked that country, destroyed its social infrastructure, completely changed it. And the Americans, this is what many people don't realize, couldn't have done this had they not had the tacit support of Iran, who hated Saddam Hussein for their own reasons, because he had fought a war with them, again at the behest of the West and armed by the West, to defeat the Iranians. So they have their own bone to pick, and you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend is a very bad principle in politics and in personal life. Not a good idea. And so they handed power in Iraq to the Shia clerical parties, and these parties were what they were and what they are, and they carried out a large-scale ethnic cleansing of Iraqis of Sunni origin in Baghdad and other cities, and prevented a combined resistance developing at a time when it could. They just stopped it in its tracks. And so this is what we witness. And in the Yemen, it's a long story, but just in a sentence, the uprising which toppled the dictatorship, the Americans tried hanging on to the dictatorship for far too long. Then the Saudis found another president to put into place, because Yemen and Saudi Arabia are the only two real ancient societies, countries in that in the Arabian Peninsula. All these Gulf states are created very recently, more or less as imperial petrol stations, you can't say origins. But Saudi Arabia and the Yemen are very strong states. And the Saudis have always resented any independence by the Yemen. There was a huge civil war fought in the 60s between Egypt and the Saudi Arabia, a real war. The Egyptian army fighting the Saudi army, the Egyptians defending the independence of southern Yemen, and the Saudis backing the hardcore tribes. So this goes back a long way. Now, ironically, under total U.S. hegemony, both the Egyptians and the Saudis are trying to destroy this the current people, because they happen to be Shias from the northern part of the country and are using this as a big mobilizing force. It's going to be incredibly messy and disastrous, in my opinion, for that whole region.
On the back.
Right at the beginning, you were saying that locally, would vote for the person that you thought was the best politician, regardless of their party. As the centre get more alike and people get bored with the blandness in the middle, do you think that there's a chance that somebody like Nigel Farage or Russell Brand could come through because people are just bored with everybody in the centre looking the same?
You said at the beginning that you would vote for the person, not the party.
Yeah.
But don't you worry that as people become bored with what they're being offered, somebody like Nigel Farage or Russell Brand could stand and could come through as a result of this?
Well, there is a huge difference between the two. both are comedians, of course. But Brand is the more successful one, but the real difference is that he's not aligned to any party. He's not created one, he's an individual, he says his piece, because he's a famous comedian and a celeb, he gets away with it. I mean, if anyone else said exactly the same things, they wouldn't be allowed anywhere near radio or television. But he gets away with it. Whereas Farage and his gang are mainly refugees from the Conservative Party. So they're not that different, really. They represent the right wing of the Conservative Party, and their main grouse is immigration and linked to is Europe and linked to that immigration, because that's what they attack the mainstream parties on, and all these parties are slowly accommodating to them. Everyone's been attacking the migrants, mainly from Eastern Europe, who are part of the EU. If you join the EU, and everyone knows this, then there is a free movement of labor and a free movement of capital. And it doesn't matter whether they're Romanians or Bulgarians, they're members of the EU or Albanians. They are. And so they travel and they have the legal right to do so. And Britain will not be able to change that unless they withdraw from the EU, which honestly I don't think, though there are some good reasons for considering that, and they have nothing to do with immigration, but the way the EU is run and how undemocratic it is. But I don't think the bulk of the British people will vote to leave the EU at the referendum. It might be 60-40 in staying in favour, or 70-30. But that's the big grouse of UKIP, as I understand. And, you know, there are people who are very deeply hostile to Europe who will probably vote for them. But my feeling is that you should always vote for a candidate you like. If there are no political parties you trust, you have no other choice but to vote for, see what's on offer, and vote for the person who you feel politically the closest to. I think the time for just voting for a party, as I stressed in the earlier part of this discussion, like rather supporting Tottenham rather than or Arsenal rather than Chelsea, it doesn't make sense anymore, because there are no fundamental differences between them. There are cultural differences, and there are differences in terms of how people look, or who looks better on television, or who's dressed better, and I think we have to move beyond that.
I'm pleased that it's in Milburn voted against the war in Iraq, and do you not think it's possible that at the moment he's under promise?
Ed Miliband voted against the war in Iraq. Don't you believe that at the moment we don't see much promise there, but given he did that, it could actually be more impressive than you're giving him credit for?
He wasn't in Parliament when the vote in Iraq was taken, so he never voted against it. He had a year off a sabbatical, and he was teaching politics at Harvard. Where I ran into him. And he was certainly not in favor of the war in Iraq at that time. That's absolutely true. Had he been in the Blair cabinet, would he have walked out? I mean, Clare Shaw was put in. But very few people actually resigned on that. But the part of your question is he not underplaying it in order to come to power? How many times did I hear that when Blair was campaigning? I promise you. Every large numbers of Labour Party members who I said I'm really nervous about this guy, my instincts are that it will end very badly. So he has to promise these things in order to get into when he does it, it never happens like that. You have to come out with what your real politics are, and if you're not elected, you're not elected. You try again. That is how democracy should function. I think there is no real desire on the part of the Labour Party leadership, as it's constituted at present, to break with what the Conservatives are doing. And the Conservatives say we're just carrying on where Blair left off. And Blair said we're carrying on from where Thatcher left off. So this is the political system that has been created, unfortunately. And in order to try and get beyond it, we have to look at other forces outside the extreme centre. Mm-hmm.
Many people on the left agonise in this election about whether they should give their support to the Labour Party. There's a lot of soul searching going on. Do you think that even figures in the calculations of the Labour Party? Or are the people who would refuse to support Labour on grounds of social democracy and social justice considered triage, just roadkill in their calculations? Are we agonising for nothing?
Many people on the left agonise about whether they should vote Labour or not in this election. Not least if they live in Oxford East, it's a marginal seat. Are these people actually of any great importance, or should they pass the ones you take for granted, or the kind of electoral roadkill?
No, I think they are very important to Labour. And some of the things the Labour people are saying are designed to appeal to these people. They're absolutely horrified that people are thinking of voting Green, for instance, but they can't compete with the Greens in terms of policies. But you know, the way to convince people is then to be very upfront and say, this is what we're going to do. And all they will say is that, no, we're not going to oppose austerity. We'll have more carefully considered cuts. Well, that's very nice. But you know, your carefully considered cuts will still be cuts. And cutting these, virtually reducing the social infrastructure of this country, using the cuts as an excuse, the Americans didn't need to do that. I mean, to be fair, Obama was better than the government here by actually creating a stimulus and trying to help. I'm not saying it's worked, but he did at least try in that sense. Whereas these people in Europe have just had a very firm neoliberal line, largely imposed by the German banks and the banks in the city of London here, which they do not dare flout. I mean, Danny referred to the section of my book, which is called The Trough, in which I explain how many former Labour cabinet ministers helped to privatise certain things and then got jobs in those same industries. You can look at the list. Yeah. It's not a very nice list. It's what we were used to the Conservatives doing because that was part of their ideology. But Labour has done it on just as big a scale.
You can buy the book for that alone. Because I haven't seen anybody collate. And I asked you about this before. I said, was anybody squeaky clean? And you told me you just lost the effort to carry on doing it after 7 pages. So, listening to all the dodgy things all these ministers have done since leaving office.
And this isn't, it's not raised as an issue by the Conservatives, because they do the same. So the more Labour is like them, the better it is for them. They are all part of the same system together. But I honestly don't think there's great... I mean, in Scotland, they agonised a lot for independence, because that's a huge leap for people in Scotland, too. And independence was lost by about 10%. But in now there's very little agonizing going on in Scotland, if the opinion polls which we believe. England, there are people, you're absolutely right, who are agonizing. I run across them all the time. But they shouldn't really. And that's one reason I wrote this written book, is to say people, this is what it's like. And it's a warning. And don't feel bad about not voting Labour any longer, because we will sooner or later need something different here, and best to prepare for it now.
Yeah. Is that over here?
Do you think that any sort of ownership to work on to my left is hindered by our elections?
Do do you think any paradigm shift in alternative economics is hindered by our electoral system?
Yes. In this country, it has been hindered by it, because we've had, if you want to be accurate, a set of minority governments from the 80s onwards. I mean, very few, I don't have the figures in front of me, but by and large it's been the case that most parties elected have been elected on the basis of first-past-the-post system, which is inherently. I mean, it's used in other parts of the world, but it's undemocratic there as well. And most of the European countries have different mechanisms, which are better. The argument often given here is that it provides stability. It's not particularly, it's no longer even provides stability, as I argued first. It's not the only thing. You know, you have it encourages more political opinions, more views to be heard and discussed in national parliaments, as you see in Scandinavia, even in Germany, where you have such a system, and to a certain extent even in France. But Britain alone, of the major European countries, is stuck with this first-past-the-post system, which is why I'm sure it will be a central feature of any discussion on a new dispensation.
You're clearly not going to stop asking questions, so I'm going to do three more, and then we'll stop.
Hey, so I was wondering, do you think we should make voting compulsory, like we do in some other countries, given that, you know, the main parties do tend to tailor their policies towards perhaps the older electorate?
Should we make voting compulsory, as they do in some other countries, to stop the parties tailoring their policies towards the older members of the electorate?
I don't think that will work, you know, but people, even if people are fined for not voting, they can go and then spoil the ballots. I mean, if they're going to do that, one must argue that together with that, we should have on the ballot paper, the last candidate should be none of the above. Because if you're, then people should have the right to say none of the above are suitable, and that should be then counted and relayed if you're going to make voting compulsory. It doesn't bring about all that much change, as we've seen in the way Australia functions, where voting is compulsory. So it's a sort of false way, I think, of trying to get people to vote. The reason people don't vote is because they feel voting will change nothing. And you know, often it's the poorer sections of society who don't bother to go out and vote. Just a fact.
Given that I think probably most people here would agree with you that we are in the twilight of democracy, and that the elimination of democracy seems necessary for this, for the continuation of capitalism, where are we going? You know, where is Britain going? You know, I've gone from anger to fear. You know, I'm not afraid of terrorists, and I'm not afraid of what they want me to be afraid of. I'm really afraid, you know, the manipulation and the impossibility of, you know, watching the news and telling the truth and react. The manipulation of everything is, it's so depressing. And even amongst myself, you know, I talk to people, they don't believe this is the twilight of democracy. They think I'm being extremist. They think, you know, whatever. And I just, you know, it is frightening. I think it's very frightening what's going on. And where are we going?
Okay, given that we are in the twilight of democracy, you know, most people don't believe it, but many of us here do. Should we be frightened? We are frightened, and where are we going?
Well, I mean, I think the fight takes place in different forms. In Greece and Spain, they're fighting them by creating new political organizations which offer people a different alternative. That always enhances democracy, however difficult it is. And despite the fact that a bulk of the media in Greece and Spain, when I say a bulk, I mean 95%, has been attacking these new formations. And despite that, one of them won an electoral victory. And the other is doing pretty well in Spain. You know, you see what happens in the elections in December. Even if they don't win outright, there will be a huge party which has jumped from 5% to sort of 16 or 17%. So it's what you do and what people do that really changes the way they think. So activity of some form or the other, political activity, is, in my view, always crucial. And that is what creates hope. Hope is a very active emotion, really. The passive emotion is despair. And even in difficult times, it's important to struggle, to fight, to do something, to be active. I mean, I've been arguing now for nearly a year. People ask me, what should we do in different parts of the country? In England, Scotland is, as I've argued, a separate case. I've said that we should, why don't we, in every single town, small and big, and in London, in different parts of it, set up committees to have a charter of demands. It's something very well known in English, is a charter. And say, this is what we stand for, we the people. We stand for a health service that is free from the market. We stand for renationalizing the railways, which, by the way, is what between 60 and 70% of the British people want. We want to take the utilities back from profits like gas, electricity, water, which is, by the way, a majority of what British people want. The majorities are small in some cases, but they are there. That this is what we stand for. And organize in October 2015, when Parliament is about to assemble, a grand remonstrance of the English people. It happened before in the 17th century. The first big grand remonstrance, which walked into Parliament and placed its demands, actually resulted in a huge upheaval, as some of you know. Well, we're not going to repeat that. But to get a million signatures in favor of this, which I'm sure could be done if people worked together, who have many other differences but agree on these core proposals, and have a million strong march to Westminster in October to present this to the assembled parliamentarians, it would have a national impact. And maybe something could grow out of it, and a lot of smaller groups like the Plaid Cymru or the Greens and others would support such a thing and would participate in it, but the aim would be to draw ordinary people in, not just people who are well known, but get them, argue with them, talk politics, and find a lot of support. No one is doing that on, you know, on the left or the right.
Last question, I'm going to take it right from the very back here. Shout out, please.
You mentioned the Chechen rally.
Yes.
In America, after bombing. And are you persuaded it's them that did it? Because following a talk by Chomsky, I looked at all the past in the past screens of all the main channels like CNN, Huffington Post, Boston Post, etc. And you see them walking, and their backpacks are of a different color than the one they show us that is blown up and has the pressure cooker inside. And the first brother's backpack is darker but still grayish. The second brother's backpack is truly light white. The blown up bags are black with the pressure cooker inside. And there is something else which none of their supporters have mentioned. The second boy's backpack is nearly empty, the one that is being judged at the moment. How could such a nearly empty backpack on the way to the marathon be containing a pressure cooker ready to blow up? So maybe you would be able to investigate it unless you're persuaded it's that.
You mentioned the two brothers in Boston. Chomsky apparently, others have said they may not have done it. One is under trial at the moment in another country. What do you think about this? And those 17 security services in general in the United States? Do
which I didn't know.
Well, that's the reality we live with. I mean, you know, obviously I'm opposed to it. What more can I say? But this is a reality which is not going to go away. We live with it. The Snowden in this documentary film made of him, made with him by Laura Poitras, said that whenever we were, when he was still working for the NSA, he said we always used to be envious of GCHQ in Britain because these guys had much less political control exercised and exerted over them than we do in the United States. That's worth thinking about. Because again, the extreme center parties are completely loyal on this. They will not challenge. They will not call these guys in, or when they call them in, they're very understanding of what is going on. And, you know, one fights it like many other things. It should certainly be part of the Charter of Demands, saying that this is what we're not in favor of. We demand democratic accountability. We want to know what these services are doing, who they're spying on, and it should be helpful to make it legal.
It's when I read that Hazel Blair was on the committee that scrutinises these security services that I realised they're not scrutinised at all. For those of you who still have questions, Tariq is going to be signing copies of the Extreme Centre at the back. Thank you ever so much for listening and all your questions and coming tonight, and thank you, Tariq.